Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
What does Hezbollah want? Why is Kenya getting involved in Haiti?
What can the world's biggest iceberg tell us?
The Inquiry. One big question.
Can we trust Google?
Four expert witnesses.
Time for our second expert witness.
And an answer.
What will be the solution?
Explore the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world with The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Sean Lay. Coming up later, a scientific breakthrough which could lead to new treatment for burns and skin diseases, erase wrinkles and defeat hair loss. But first, members of the NATO military alliance will this week debate what Ukraine's President Zelensky calls a victory plan. Addressing the country's parliament, he said the objective was to force Russia to negotiate in good faith.
Запрошення для України в НАТО може стати дійсно...
An invitation for Ukraine to join NATO could become truly fundamental for peace. We understand that NATO membership is a matter for the future, not the present, but Putin must see that his geopolitical calculations have failed. I thank all our partners who support the idea that inviting Ukraine to NATO now, with membership later, strengthens everyone.
Well, after Mr. Zelensky's address, the new Secretary-General of NATO, the former Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte, said the organisation was fully behind Ukrainians.
NATO stands shoulder to shoulder with Ukraine now and into the future. We are working, and with urgency, to deliver a new NATO command to coordinate security assistance and training for Ukraine. More support to build Ukraine's future forces. A financial pledge of at least 40 billion euros of military aid within a year, and initiatives to support Ukraine on its irreversible path to NATO membership.
On the streets of the capital, Kyiv, these people were broadly supportive of the plan, but also weary of the war.
I think the people want to end the war just as soon as possible. Many victims from our country has been died, and now we don't know for what we are struggle.
As all people, we try to find something positive, some hope, you know. Hopefully we will survive through the winter, through the hard times. But in general, I agree. I think we should not give up territory, but still, hopefully, we will gain the possibility to join NATO, and we will get more support from our allies.
If we will have some guarantees, and these guarantees will be really security for our land, okay, we can discuss some variants. It depends on these guarantees, I think.
Well, in truth, the plan underlines how far Ukraine's options are likely to be determined by its allies. Inviting Ukraine to join NATO, permission to use long-range weapons supplied by the allies against targets inside Russia, and a package of deterrence measures to keep the Russians out. The plan includes sweeteners in return for that support. In return for protecting Ukraine's natural resources, European Union countries and the United States will be able to exploit them economically. Post-war, Ukraine is also offering to provide its troops to replace some of the American ones who are currently stationed across Europe. However, the speech contained no specific mention of Ukraine regaining control of all the territory it had so far lost to Russia, both in this war and in the earlier annexation of Ukraine. In the earlier annexation of Crimea. So was it more interesting, therefore, for what Zelensky didn't say? That's a question I put to Phillips O'Brien, Professor of Strategic Studies at the University of St Andrews in Scotland.
It is interesting. I mean, it's implied in certain places, say when he talks about the lithium deposits, you know, most of those are in the Donbass. But on the other hand, he doesn't explicitly say, you know, we want every inch of our territory back. So he's sort of having it both ways, but he does also say very clearly in the address that this peace plan is to lead to negotiations. This is all to help us in negotiations. And so by having negotiations, you'd usually do a give and a take.
He does also say in this that there would be a continuation of Ukraine's military operations on Russian territory to avoid creation of buffer zones inside Ukraine. It's very hard, isn't it, in a negotiation to see Russia accepting that?
Well, I mean, I think what Zelensky's trying to do is say, look to the West, and particularly to the United States and European NATO countries. It is in your interest to have us in the tent. If you have us in the tent, you have greater security and you have greater economic resources. And if you do that and you invite us in, then Russia really is going to have to accept it because Russia has no alternative. So if you leave us out, then yes, you're going to allow Russia to bully us. We are going to always be, in some ways, under threat to Russia. But what are Russia's alternatives? Can they use nuclear weapons? Well, that's actually quite unlikely, I would say. But if we don't have the guarantees, then we will always have this pressure from Russia coming down on us.
The question then is whether you think that this will be embraced by the allies, and let's be honest, particularly the United States.
Well, I don't think it'll be embraced by the Biden administration. I mean, they basically seem to be holding Ukraine at arm's length right now. So we don't know, you know, I think everyone's waiting for the American presidential election. If Trump wins, I can't see this plan going anywhere.
Even though there is this, what looks like a sweetness saying, look, you know, impractically, President Trump, if you were to be back in office, we would help allow you to relieve some of your American soldiers because you're always grumbling that that the Europe is too dependent on the Americans.
There actually aren't that many American soldiers. I mean, you know, I think America compared to the Cold War is mostly left a lot of these soldiers. So it is, that actually is a point for the American sort of Republican voter. But I don't think it's actually one that, because it's based on the assumption that the Trumpite arguments are being made in good faith, but they're not being made in good faith. Trump just wants out, and he's looking for reasons to say why the United States shouldn't be in Europe.
And what about Kamala Harris? Because she was asked about NATO, I think, in the last week or so, and she said that standard line, when the time is right, which didn't sound terribly enthusiastic.
No, I have to say, on the whole, she's been much more pro-Ukraine, actually, than Biden, except that one line. That if you look at something like her acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention and other talks, she has been actually very forceful pro-Ukrainian, speaking about Ukrainian victory and things like that. However, that way she spoke about NATO made it sound like actually she's probably going to be like Biden. So we don't know. We don't want to overrate to one comment because it really was just one comment. And she has her own foreign policy team. But I think we can say there are sort of mixed signals about which way she would go. Yeah. But the only way this plan has any hope at all, is if she wins. Otherwise, it's doomed.
Professor Philip O'Brien at the St Andrews University in Scotland. Oleksandr Mereshko chairs the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Ukrainian Parliament. He's a member of President Zelensky's party, Servant of the People. I asked him what he made of the president's plan.
Well, to me, it's a very clear-cut and very concrete plan. It's not abstract. It contains very concrete steps which should be achieved for Ukraine to survive and to defeat Russia. That's why it's called Victory Plan.
Well, let's take one specific example. This requirement, you say, that the President Zelensky says is absolutely needed, which is authorization for the use of long-range weapons provided by Western allies to hit targets inside Russia. President Biden will be in Europe on Thursday. The White House said tonight there's going to be $425 million worth of weapons from the Department of Defense stocks. But no authorization for using its long-range weapons is mentioned at all. Hasn't the US effectively rejected a key part of the Zelensky plan already?
I don't think so. I believe that maybe it will not be made public, such permission to use long-range missiles produced in the West deep into the territory of Russia. But all we need other partners, our allies, not to stand in the way of the use of long-range missiles in the territory of Russia, because it's absolute military necessity for Ukraine. Without this, we cannot win the asymmetric war against Russia.
Accelerated timetable for membership of NATO is, of course, not the same as actual membership. So how would speeding up the timetable make a difference? How would that bring Russia to the negotiating table?
First of all, it will make a huge political and even strategic difference, because it will actually destroy Putin's plans, and it will show that Putin has suffered tremendous strategic defeat, because Putin claimed that his war against Ukraine was all about NATO. And if we receive this invitation, it means that our desire, our prospects to become full-fledged member state of NATO is irreversible.
Solomaya Bobrovska, an MP from the opposition Holos party, said the plan shows what allies can do. Unfortunately, she said, I don't think the US is very receptive of this plan.
Well, we need to continue to persuade our allies, and we have success in this regard. And we have already like-minded people and our allies, for example, in the United States, both Democrats and Republicans. There are lots of them who support Ukraine.
Sure there are. But Professor O'Brien said he can't see this victory plan going anywhere if Donald Trump wins. Do you agree with that?
I don't agree with that, because no matter who becomes the next American president, and we cannot predict right now who will be the president, he or she will have to follow American national interests. And it's in the best American interest to support Ukraine.
Is the significance not so much what the president said as what he did not say? For example, he did not in this speech, as he has said in previous speeches, that all Ukrainian territory must be evacuated by Russia, that was thought to be a red line. Is it no longer a red line?
It is absolutely remains a red line. There is no question about it. Our president has emphasized many, many times that any territorial concessions are absolutely out of question. It's against our constitution. It's against international law. It's against everything.
It may be against all those things, but, you know, de facto on the ground for the last decade, Crimeans have lived under Russian control. They may not like it, but it is their daily experience. We hear just tonight the TASS News agency in Russia reporting two more villages being captured in Krasny Yar, in Donetsk and Nevsk in the Luhansk region. Significant proportion of your country is not under your control. In the end, isn't it the case that you will be negotiating from a relative position of weakness?
I don't think so, because first of all, it makes no sense to negotiate with Putin, who is a pathological liar and who had broken all treaties and agreements with Ukraine.
So you're waiting for a change of leadership, are you?
Well, we don't rule out. Everything can happen. A coup d'etat in Russia, it happened in history. So he can be removed by Russian elite. It's a possibility. It can happen. Why not?
In practical terms, this plan depends on your allies. Do you really think promising them a kind of financial bung, which is effectively what you're saying, you can help exploit our natural resources if you help us get back control of your country, is going to be enough to convert them when they've been so sceptical over the last 2.5 years?
Well, first of all, it's one of the arguments. Another argument is that Ukraine will not be a burden for NATO, because we have very experienced troops, and we will be an asset of great value for NATO, for the West. And the West should be interested in having resources, strategic resources, for example, like uranium, on the side of free world, not on the side of totalitarian regimes like Russia and
China. But that is currently under the control of the Russians. And the allies aren't going to go in and help you get it back.
Well, that's why we need to follow what our president has suggested as a victory plan. It's very clear. It's very obvious. And if we act together, we can win. And we should win this war against Russian aggressor.
That's Oleksandr Mareshko, chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in Ukraine's parliament, on President Zelensky's victory plan. This is NewsHour. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Sean Lay. Coming up in the course of this hour, we're going to be hearing from NewsHour's Mohamed Hashim, who makes a tearful return to his family home in Sudan, where a civil war has been raging for 18 months.
Everything has been looted or destroyed or damaged.
How is this war going to end? I don't know. Inshallah, God willing, one day we'll be able to come back. The people who used to live here will try and build new lives.
Our headlines this hour. The United States says it's closely monitoring Israel to ensure that enough aid is allowed through to civilians in northern Gaza. And Lebanon has accused Israel of deliberately targeting local officials in its latest wave of deadly airstrikes. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. Georgia is just over a week from parliamentary elections, which could help to determine whether it tilts west towards the EU or east towards Russia. There have been mass protests against what's known as the Foreign Agents Law passed by Georgian Dream, the party that's been in power for over a decade. Increasingly hostile to the West in its rhetoric, Georgian Dream hopes its mandate will be renewed, something the opposition says would be catastrophic for democracy. The BBC's Rayhan Dimitri reports now on what's at stake.
A rally for one of Georgia's pro-Western opposition coalitions in the city of Kutaisi. Our future is in Europe, cries one of its leaders. For many at the rally, the October 26 parliamentary elections are a referendum on Georgia's future, whether to be with Europe or with Russia.
We don't need Russia because Russia occupied our country 20% or more.
Can I say also important for our country is that we have free economics, free education and also justice.
Only Europe, no to Russia, says this voter.
Russia's war in Ukraine has featured prominently in the campaign of the governing Georgian Dream Party. Here in the capital, Tbilisi, GD's blue posters are everywhere. Their billboards contrast images of war-torn Ukraine, showing bombed-out Ukrainian churches, burnt public buses and other scenes with their peaceful Georgian equivalents. Choose peace, not war, is their message. And that resonates with many in a country of 3.7 million which borders Russia and suffered a short but devastating conflict with its neighbor in 2008. In Georgia's Black Sea town of Batumi, the billionaire founder of the governing Georgian Dream, Bidzina Ivanishvili, is addressing a crowd of supporters. Mr. Ivanishvili made his fortune in Russia in the 1990s. And since the invasion of Ukraine, his governing party has gone out of its way not to offend Moscow, while also warning that the West wants to drag Georgia into Ukraine's war. He has promised to outlaw the country's main opposition party.
Today, the collective UNM, United National Movement, who are supported from abroad, is trying to come to power through unrest and get this country entangled in war and chaos. This is the end, once and for all.
But the real threat, says one of the leaders of the Coalition for Change, Nika Gvaramia, is the loss of Georgian democracy, along with a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to join the European Union.
There is no such thing as, some kind of threat to peace in Georgia. That's, Russian propaganda, definitely. It's not, so it's a dichotomy of peace and war. It's dichotomy of Europe and Russia.
Gvaramia's party and his coalition aims to attract Georgia's Gen Z voters. Earlier this year, tens of thousands of young people protested against a foreign influence bill, which they called the Russian Law. The law requires media and civil society groups funded from abroad to register as acting in the interests of a foreign power. Protesters saw it as a threat to the country's democracy and its future in Europe. The law was the final straw for Georgia's Western partners. Brussels has suspended the accession process for Georgia to join the EU. Washington has cancelled direct financial aid to the Georgian government and sanctioned some officials. Zviad Adzimbaya from the Fletcher School at Tufts University says the US sanctions are aimed at the authorities, not the Georgian population, 80% of whom say they want to be part of Europe.
Sanctions are terrible. But also an opportunity for the Georgians to wake up, honestly, really wake up, do one thing, nothing else, show up and vote.
That's Ziad Adzimbaya talking to Rayhan Dimitri in Georgia. Be comfortable, they say, with the skin you're in. Fine for most of us, but what if your skin is damaged? A team of scientists has just announced they've mapped human skin in its entirety and identified which genes trigger cells to develop. They've also used this breakthrough to grow skin in the lab. I've been talking with one of the team, Professor Muhsin Efur of the Wellcome Sanger Institute near Cambridge in the UK. First, why is this such a significant breakthrough?
The reason it's significant is we did not know how the human skin was built. And what we've provided is the complete map and the recipe of how the skin forms, how it's built. And this is just the basic map that is required for us to now know how to, you know, cure diseases, how to basically grow hair, how to prevent scarring in the skin, and how the skin ages.
Now, that sounds an extraordinary range of applications for this. How have you achieved that?
So this is all to do with the genes that are expressed in individual cells. And what we've worked out is which ones are switched on and which ones are switched off that gives the cells the identity and the function. And it's extremely complex, the skin, because you have different cells that do very different things. Some of them form your sweat glands, some of them form your hair follicles, some of them form your blood vessels. So how is this intricate, you know, formation of tissue or skin occurring? And that's really how we did it. And we did it by measuring the gene expression of those individual cells.
Now, when you say it could help to cure some diseases, what sorts of things are you thinking of?
When we undertook the study, we grew skin in a dish, organoid. And what we found was this skin in a dish more likely resembled prenatal skin rather than adult skin. And that's really important because this tells you that it will be a very good model to study skin diseases that occur before birth. So a lot of congenital or inherited skin diseases. And some of them are really, really devastating and cause blistering and can lead to death. So we can now look at it in a dish, be able to induce the mutations that cause these diseases and watch how the disease evolves and find ways to prevent that progression or to revert the skin so that it becomes healthy skin again.
And prenatal skin has certain qualities that you hope you can duplicate, as it were, in adult skin when you're doing things like helping people, for example, who've had burns.
So prenatal skin has two very unique properties. It is the only time in our life when the hair actually forms from scratch. After birth, the hair cycles. So we won't be able to kind of form any new hair, so to speak. Whatever hair that's lost is lost. But before birth, you can actually watch this formation happening. And so we learn how hair is formed. The second unique property of prenatal skin is that it heals without scarring.
Ah.
And that is incredible. If you can crack that, I mean, imagine being able to have surgery and, you know, not having a scar at the end of it. The applications are just enormous.
I can hear some people listening and thinking, ah, could this be new hope for those whose skin has perhaps become a little aged?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely, because prenatal skin is, you know, very versatile. And if we can figure out what the molecular code, what's the secret that we can unlock from there, then we can always have rejuvenative therapies and applications to stop us from aging. And hopefully, potentially reverse aging of the skin.
What a prospect. Professor Muhsin Efur of the Wellcome Sanger Institute near Cambridge in the UK. You are listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Stay with us.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news, with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, the documentary, and the Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Next to the pyramids, just outside Cairo, the Grand Egyptian Museum opened on Wednesday. It's taken more than 20 years to build, delayed on more than one occasion by Egypt's tumultuous politics. It now houses the largest collection of ancient Egyptian artefacts in the world. Not bad when you consider Egypt's long period under foreign control, when many items ended up with European collectors. For an assessment of what awaits the visitor, NewsHour's Paul Henley has been speaking to Salim Ekram, Professor of Egyptology at the American University in Cairo.
This is the first day that the museum is properly open, and now I am standing inside the Middle Kingdom room, and I'm surrounded by these beautiful cases, which are well lit, and there are boat models on one side, animals made out of wood and papier-mâché, and then the other side is statues of all kinds of people, old and young, sitting and standing. Fantastic and beautifully coloured hieroglyphs.
Why is such a collection so important to the world, would you say?
Well, I mean, being an Egyptologist, of course, I'm biased, but I do think that having all of these objects from the continual history of ancient Egypt, starting from 5000 BC, going into the Roman era, in one place is a spectacular way of engaging with history and seeing things that go from all over Egypt. So it is not just, you know, a continuum spectrum of history, but also changes in how writing developed, religion changed, and customs have evolved, and the view of kingship also changing over time, or maybe not quite so much changing.
It must be, to an extent, a political statement by the government saying that they have this state-of-the-art facility to show off Egyptian history best.
Indeed, I think that museums and artefacts have always been used for political ends by either their own government or someone else's. And certainly here, this is a grand statement saying that Egypt is both an ancient and a modern country, and it has a vast history that the world should reckon with.
I wonder if there's a particular exhibit you can focus on just for a moment to explain the importance of this museum, something you're looking at now.
There is one of the most extraordinary displays that I have ever seen here. And we know that the ancient Egyptians wrote a lot, but how they learnt to write is something that we don't know as much about. And what they do have are these wooden boards, which have been covered with a thin layer of plaster, and then people would write on them, and then you could wash it off and practice. And some of them bearing the last owner's sort of imprint. So some of them have got sketches, other ones have texts, some of them have corrections. For someone who teaches, of course, it's quite nice to see that, because although there are computers, I still do get people to do write me my essays by hand sometimes. And so it's quite a lovely thing to see someone's corrections 3,000 years later. Of course, what everyone else is waiting for is the great Tutankhamun gallery, which is still closed. And I suppose that will be the grand finale.
Professor Salim Ekram talking to Paul Henley. This is NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Sean Lay. The governor of Nabatea province in southern Lebanon has accused Israel of targeting local officials in an airstrike on Wednesday morning. The mayor of Nabatea city was killed along with four of his colleagues. In total, 16 people are known to have died when the city was hit. Reportedly, the mayor was holding a meeting to coordinate assistance for people who've been affected by the recent airstrikes. Israel said strikes both in Nabatea and in the south of the capital Beirut were aimed at Hezbollah. Well, the Nabatea Governmental Hospital is one of those that's been treating the city's injured. Dr. Hassan Wazni, its director general, told me what had happened.
Today, from the morning when it started, it was catastrophic. It was very, very hard and strong, and the city completely destroyed. Here, we received 36 injured and 3 fatalities, 3 martyrs. There other hospital also received many of martyrs and fatalities.
What sort of injuries are you treating?
Brain, leg, shoulder, abdominal, some burn, different kind of injury.
How large a town is Nabatea, and how is your hospital and the other hospitals coping with this?
Nabatea is the center of this region, this area, the center, the biggest city in the south, in Nabatea.
How many people have remained in the city?
I don't know. I today I was shocked with this number of patients and of injured and of people. They still live here, and they went to the municipality to have some help, some support, some maybe food also. They were many there. I don't know where if this big number were still living here, as is, because the situation from one week became dangerous. But today was a maximum. That yeah. was a peak today.
Are the strikes still going on?
Yes, I heard, but it's around the city. Every 10 minutes, every 15 minutes, we can hear this strike.
Did you see anything in treating the injured people to suggest that any of them could have been militia, could have been part of Hezbollah?
Not really. I don't know. You know, here at this hospital, the majority are civilian. The majority. I don't know if between them there are others. We have a hospital. We
of course
treat any patient and any injury than any who come to our hospital.
Just one more question, if I may. If these bombardments, these attacks continue, how long can your hospital, can your colleagues keep going, do you think?
Not long. We have shortage in fuel and in many things. We don't have electricity here, and we should work with the generator. I asked to have some fuel from Beirut. Do you know we need more than 2,000 liters per day? And so without electricity, you know, we can't work. We can't do anything. Things get harder and get more difficult.
Dr. Hassan Wozni in Nabatea. The United Nations says the huge scale of displacement in Lebanon, estimated to involve about one-fifth of the population, could result in a catastrophic humanitarian crisis. As our correspondent Jonathan Head told me on NewsHour yesterday, state institutions are so fragile and the economy so weak that private individuals are helping one another. Jonathan's been out and about to see that compassion in action.
So I'm strolling along Beirut's famous Corniche, the seaside promenade popular with joggers, fishermen and street vendors. But these days there are also tents and groups of families sitting around who've been displaced by the Israeli bombing campaign. More than a million people, one-fifth of Lebanon's population, has been uprooted by the conflict. Tens of thousands of them here in the capital in just the last few weeks. The needs are enormous and the government is unable to meet them. So ordinary people have stepped in to help each other. Well, we've come to a restaurant in Beirut's Hamra district. Like so many parts of the city, it's accommodating huge numbers of people who've been displaced by the conflict. And this restaurant, Mezian, is doing its bit to help by offering free meals to those who had to leave their homes.
My name is Shad Hamdan. I'm the operations manager of Mezian.
So what are you cooking here?
It's rice and meat with the sauce, with the pepper sauce, and we distribute it to the people.
Tell me why you started this.
As you know, it's always bad situations here in Lebanon. Now this war displaced people from south, from Beirut suburbs. We are trying to do something, and as we are at the restaurant, we are preparing food for these people to just help them with at least one meal per day, because you know the prices now are really high, and maybe they're coming without their money, and some of them they lost already their houses, their job. So we are trying to do something. So now we reach like 500 meals daily. You know, some apartments, four or five families, like 20 people in the same house. So we are trying our best to reach what we can do for them only.
And you're still running a normal restaurant business on top of this?
Exactly. I think the business is going down like 70% from before. But at the same time, we're trying to help the displaced people here in Beirut.
So we're zipping through Beirut's crazy traffic. I'm on the back of a bike with Jad, carrying food for the Salum family. They've had to take in
a lot of relatives in just one small apartment.
Hello. So we've arrived. Shukran, thank you. So, Ali, how many people are living in this apartment?
Around 15.
15?
Yeah.
Very crowded.
Yeah. We are like a family.
A big family?
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't know how long this will last, do you?
No, we don't know, but we are hoping to end very soon.
So no privacy for you here?
No, everywhere no privacy. And there's no safety, and everywhere is, maybe it's going to be bombing. No one knows. You're going to go outside on the street, and you don't know if you're going to come back or no.
You never feel safe?
No. Thanks God, we are still alive for now.
Jonathan Head with Beirut's Helping Hands. A reminder of our top story this hour. President Biden won't meet his Ukrainian counterpart when he visits Europe in the coming days, but more US military assistance is on its way to Kyiv for its war with Russia. Earlier today, President Zelensky set out what he called his path to victory, which includes accelerated membership of NATO. Ukrainian MP Alexander Mereshko told me on NewsHour why this would be a good thing for the West.
Ukraine will not be a burden for NATO because we have very experienced troops and will be an asset of great value for NATO, for the West. And the West should be interested in having resources, strategic resources, for example, like uranium on the side of free world.
One other headline this hour, the United States says it is closely monitoring Israel to ensure that enough humanitarian aid is allowed through to civilians in northern Gaza. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour live from the BBC studios in London. 18 months ago this week, a civil war erupted in Africa, which has resulted in the worst humanitarian crisis the world is currently facing. Millions of people have been displaced within Sudan or become refugees in its neighbours. In some parts of the country, there is famine. NewsHour's Mohamed Hashim has been back to the city of Omdurman, his birthplace, to search for his family, friends and what was his home.
So I finally arrived in my neighborhood in Omdurman. Almorada Avenue is empty. The destruction is everywhere. Fronts of the houses are smashed. You can see the old slogans of the revolution are everywhere. I can see signs of the looting. Salaam alaikum. Alhamdulillah. So I just bumped into my neighbor, Haysam Shibeka. He's never left the neighborhood. And all the houses around him were occupied by the RSF. They were sleeping everywhere. And the extent of the devastation was total. Haysam lives opposite the masjid. We're now walking into the masjid for the prayer. The masjid appears to be fine. No signs of the destruction that you can see elsewhere.
Al-Hashmab is one of the old neighborhoods in the city. Our ancestors moved here in the late 19th century after they pledged allegiance to the Mahdi, the founder of Omdurman. My mother's grandfather built this mosque in the 1930s, and it is reassuring to come and find the faithful still hold their prayers here. It's strange to attend the mosque with so few people attending a Friday prayer. Only three rows. I leave the mosque to visit my second cousin, Wafa.
She stayed alone in the house with a couple of ladies. And I don't know what she's going to tell me. And I don't think she's expecting me. So it's going to be a surprise for her. Assalamu alaikum.
My aunt Wafa tells me of the ordeals they endured. She speaks of intimidation, theft, physical and verbal abuse, and terror.
It's good that I managed to come and visit my auntie Wafa. It's reassuring that she's managed to survive the worst month. But she's still standing. They've stolen everything she has, but she's relying on Allah and her faith.
It is time to see my house. This is possibly the hardest bit of this journey, visiting my family home where I grew up as a child.
I'm looking at the house before I go inside because I feel it's going to be heavy. Let's go into the house, I guess. Everything has been looted or destroyed or damaged.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Look at the destruction of it. Thank God that the pictures and the photographs are here. This is a diary of RSF soldiers stating the number of the force that was stationed here on the 3rd of October 2023. There were 35 RSF fighters here. The guy in charge, his name is Mahmoud, and what they had in terms of rations. Evidence of war. That's my father's PhD, a copy of it. And my grandmother's prayer beads. How is this war going to end? I don't know. Inshallah, God willing, one day we'll be able to come back. And the people who used to live here will try and build new lives.
Well, Mohanid Hashim is now back in London, came into the NewsHour studio earlier and told me what undertaking the trip to Sudan has meant to him.
It was a difficult assignment, but there was a relief in visiting the neighborhood where I grew up. There was relief in seeing how resilient people were and how holding on to hope that a better tomorrow will come. I think that's one of the key things that one takes, is many people hope that one day the guns will be silent and they'll be able to rebuild their lives.
You talked from your experience there about the damage that the paramilitaries, the RSF, had done. Presumably both sides have been doing some pretty horrendous things as they fight over Sudan's future.
According to the UN fact-finding mission, the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, and the Sudanese military have both been accused of carrying out war crimes. In the case of the Sudanese armed forces, they're accused of indiscriminate bombing, aerial bombardment of civilian areas. And the military is also accused of carrying arbitrary detentions. But it's worth pointing that in my trip to Sudan, we visited around three cities. And most of the people I spoke to or the people we saw were people who had been impacted by the rapid support forces. And if you look at Khartoum, the majority of the people who had been displaced in the capital had been displaced by the RSF.
18 months in, what is the state of play between these two sides in terms of the fighting, in terms of any sense of either of them actually making any progress towards their objectives, which is presumably to beat the other side?
What I can say is that at the moment, since around the 26th of September, the Sudanese army has been conducting what appears to be the largest offensive of the war in the capital. They've crossed into two cities, which is Khartoum proper and Khartoum North. There are other operations taking place in the west of the country, and there have been military operations in the south of the country around Sinnar State, where the army recaptured the strategic Jabal Moya hills. So it seems that the army's offensive is gaining momentum. But from the other side, the Rapid Support Forces commander, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, delivered a speech last week in which he accused Egypt of carrying out aerial bombardment to support SAF. I claim many see
SAF being the Sudanese armed forces.
The Sudanese armed forces, correct. Many people think that this is him trying to raise the stakes and to show that there are other parties that are involved in this war. On the other hand, the Sudanese military has been accusing the United Arab Emirates of backing the rapid support forces. And in all of this, the American-Saudi-led mediation effort has not borne fruit. And one of the criticisms that you hear from people in Sudan is, why hasn't the American mediator, Mr. Tom Perriello, visited the Sudanese army or the generals in Port Sudan? And he's caught up in a paradox that today the United Arab Emirates, that backs the Rapid Support Forces, has become one of the U.S.'s key strategic allies in the region.
Thanks to Mohamed Hashim for coming into the studio, and thanks to you for listening to NewsHour. I'm Sean Lay.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news, with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, The Documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.